Good evening. My name is Alcinda Honwana, and I am a Centennial Professor here at LSE. And today, I'm happy to announce the launch of Citing Africa, a podcast that explores the production of knowledge in and about Africa. The Citing Africa team, composed by Laura Mann, Seremaya Wulobi, and team Inan Elkadi, conducted research and a series of interviews to investigate inequalities in international education and the kinds of knowledge produced, consumed, and cited about Africa. They produced 9 episodes, which will be released over the next 9 weeks, on the website of the Africa Center. And this is the link, so please take note and share it with your friends, acquaintances. Share it widely, please. And Citing Africa will be released along with blog posts that will follow the podcasts. And people are encouraged to share ideas and viewpoints on Twitter. So if someone has a burning idea about a podcast, please get in touch with the Citing Africa team. So tonight's launch event, which is part of the LSE's Festival on World Disorders, will focus on decolonizing curriculum. This topic is really befitting the theme of the festival, because decolonizing is a process of disordering the established order. But what is decolonization, and what do we mean by decolonizing the academy or the curriculum? Let me start by sharing a few interesting quotes, if I know what to do. Yeah. So, Ngugi wa Thiong'o, a Kenyan novelist, said, and I quote, "Decolonization is about rejecting the centrality of the West in Africans' understanding of itself and its place in the world. It is about recentering ourselves intellectually and culturally." Another interesting quote from Fanon in The Wretched of the Earth, and Fanon says, "Decolonization is a process of remaking, a violent phenomenon that has as its goal the creation of a new humanity." I'll also share a quote by Maldonado Torres, a Puerto Rican theorist of modernity and decoloniality, that states that decoloniality requires that the institutions that are meant to serve society become a space that critically assess and seek to dismantle the imperatives of white privilege and superiority instead of serving as their guardian. The very act of decolonizing generates anxiety and settles one's sense of well-being and belonging and calls identities into question. And finally, a quote by Boaventura Sousa Santos, a Portuguese sociologist, who asserts that decolonizing is fundamental to address what he calls epistemicide, the murder of knowledge. And he says that the colonization project involved the destruction of the social practices and the disqualification of the social agents that operate according to such knowledge. And therefore, through these quotes, we can see that processes of decolonization constitute intense undertakings that require fundamental and profound systemic change. And historically in Africa, decolonization processes have been linked to the anti-colonial liberation struggles, in the ex-Portuguese colonies, for example, my own country, Mozambique, Angola, Guinea-Bissau, Cabo Verde, that had long processes of war struggling against colonialism. But it's also linked to movements such as Pan-Africanism, Negritude, Black Consciousness, African Renaissance, and other. Within the academy, decolonization has meant the establishment of alternative epistemologies of knowledge and the production of new intellectual capital. And we have seen that through several studies, like subaltern studies, when South Asian scholars in the 70s and 80s looked at the way, using the Gramsci's adopted term of subaltern, which means those of inferior rank, to look at the marginalized, to look at the colonized. But also in critical race theory, several studies were made in which race was examined as a socially constructed category rather than a biological one. But also feminist theory gave a lot of contributions to decolonization theory, and also dependency theory and the famous Dar es Salaam school, and we might all remember the Walter Rodney and how Europe developed Africa and all the things that followed from there in the development dependency theory. And nowadays, we had the hashtag Roads Must Fall movement that started at UCT in South Africa in 2015 and then spread to other African universities, but also to Oxford University here in UK. And we will hear about this a little more when Simu Kai shares some of his thoughts with us. And these movements, these contemporary movements, are really contesting the dominance of Western epistemologies, methodologies, and scholarship, as well as the silencing of alternative voices and sites of knowledge production. And they are calling for an increased student and faculty diversity in centers of knowledge production. They are also calling for greater representation of non-whites and more diversity of knowledge and perspectives in the curriculum. I just want to share with you this graph that I found, in fact, a friend of mine found and sent it to me this morning because she knew I was preparing this talk. It was in The Guardian. So it's the number of male professors in the UK Academy, and this is a statistical report of 2018. As you can see, of 14,205 male professors, more than 12,000 are white, and also only 9 are black. This is about female professors. Of the UK's 4,735 female professors, more than 4,000 are white, while only 25 are black women. So in a way, this illustrates the whole movement and why and the importance of bringing new perspectives and decolonizing the academy and the curriculum. Decolonizing the curriculum, however, it's not just about content or adding a few new sources or alternative knowledge here and there, but it's essentially about changing power relations in teaching and learning processes. We need to focus on the relationship between knowledge and power, ask new sets of questions, interrogate established assumptions, resurface subjugated knowledge, and recenter the knowledge production process. In conclusion, I would say that decolonizing curriculum calls for a deep understanding of how colonial domination and white supremacy informed and shaped current institutional cultures, values, practices, processes, appointments, curriculum, etc. And universities should not be static or ideological zombies, as my friend Suren Pillay puts it. Universities must be sites of ongoing critique and debate, sites of innovation and renewal, sites of subversion and rebellion. And tonight, this session aims at enlarging our conversations, our analysis and investigations of decolonization in the sphere of knowledge production and higher education. And we have this excellent panel of thinkers that is going to guide us through this conversation tonight. And I'm very pleased to be among them, and I'm going to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Simuka Ishigudu. He's an associate professor of African politics and a fellow at St. Anthony College at Oxford University. Dr. Ishigudu has been working on the social politics of inequality in Africa, using disease, public health, violence, and social suffering as organizing frameworks for both historical and contemporary case studies. He has conducted research in Zimbabwe, Uganda, the Gambia, Tanzania, and South Africa. And prior to joining the academy, he was a medical doctor with the UK's National Health Service. And he's just published extensively and is currently finishing a monograph entitled The Political Life of an Epidemic, Cholera, Crisis, and Citizenship in Zimbabwe. So, Simukai, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you kindly for that warm introduction. It's absolutely wonderful to be here and to see such a fantastic collection of diverse faces interested in this project of decolonization. Now, just this afternoon, before I left Oxford, I was attending a governing body meeting for St. Anthony's College, one of the privileges or burdens, depending on your perspective, when you become an associate professor at Oxford is you have to sit as a fellow in one of the colleges and govern it, apparently. And at the meeting, one of the rituals we had to go through was for me to introduce myself to the governing body for the first time, outlining my background, my history, my scholarship, and so forth. So I told my colleagues a little bit about myself and then signaled that my new research agenda was going to be moving more into the politics of knowledge production and contrasting the social and the global health sciences in creating an image, an idea of Africa. And crucial to this project was what I call disrupting whiteness. And in fact, I told my colleagues that I'd be coming to the LSE this evening to share a few thoughts on what it might mean to disrupt whiteness. The silence was deafening. None of my colleagues particularly saw the humor or intellectual impetus behind such a project. And in fact, afterwards, one of them pulled me aside, absolutely delighted that I'd come forward and said, I think that's the first time that the phrase disrupting whiteness has ever been used in this college or in a governing body meeting. So with that in mind, that's the theme I'm going to speak to this evening. And I will be speaking very much from my vantage point as an associate professor in Oxford University, as a young black African trying to make his way through the world and through the academy. Now, in December 2015, Will Hutton, a noted and celebrated political economist, left-wing commentator and columnist for The Guardian, wrote an op-ed in which he said that were it not for the legacies of the British Empire, South Africa would descend into unaccountable despotism as embodied by then-President Jacob Zuma. Mr. Hutton went on to argue that indeed it was empire that had bequeathed South Africa with such institutions as the courts, constitutionalism, rule of law, freedom of speech, freedom of association, and democracy. One inevitably wonders what history books Mr. Hutton has been reading that somehow equated apartheid with the freedom of association. In his op-ed, he went on to give a tokenistic nod to Nelson Mandela as a figure of genuine African political leadership, but beyond that seemed to hold no conception of Africans as historical agents capable of forging their own political destinies. Around the same time, the Regius Professor of Moral and Pastoral Theology at Oxford University at Christ Church College, Nigel Bigger, also wrote an op-ed, this one published in The Times, in which he said that Cecil John Rhodes was no racist and that the charges of racism against him were unfounded and his actions and his words need to be taken within the context of their time. He then, in a public speech at the Oxford Union, said that while it is disputed whether or not Cecil John Rhodes actually said that he preferred land to niggers was beside the point. Rhodes was merely a product of his time. Now, both of these authors on opposite ends of the British political spectrum were speaking to and in reaction to the Rhodes Must Fall movement that at that point was sweeping through Oxford University, raising a host of questions about the institution's iconography, about the makeup of its faculty and its student body, and about the about the curriculum, particularly those spanning the humanities and the social sciences, wherein decisions about whose voices are heard and represented, what epistemologies are privileged and deemed canonical, are frequently debated. But it wasn't only these two stuffy old men reacting somewhat petulantly against Rhodes Must Fall. Even the celebrated classicist, public intellectual, and Cambridge professor Mary Beard wrote at the time that Rhodes Must Fall represented a dangerous attempt to erase the past, and she encouraged students like myself at the time to look upon the statue with a cheery sense of self-confidence and unbatterability. One might, of course, ask Professor Beard, whose history was in danger of being erased by bringing to light the legacies of racialized trauma, exploitation, and colonialism that Cecil John Rhodes had left in his wake. Moreover, one might put to Professor Beard why it is indeed that a cheery sense of self-confidence and unbatterability is the commensurate response to the legacy of CJR. Now, I bring all of this up to highlight that these commentaries spanning the British political spectrum, but at the same time quite representative of the liberal establishment, betrayed a certain kind of common sense, a certain idea of Britain's place in the world, a blindness to the true legacies of the British Empire, and knowingly or unknowingly, a certain idea of the proper way in which students from outside of Britain ought to conduct themselves in these venerated institutions of learning. If I were being charitable, I might say that institutions like Oxford and Cambridge are perhaps not institutionally racist, but certainly ambiguous spaces of inclusion and exclusion. The Rhodes Must Fall saga demonstrated, in my view and beyond much contention, that to be African, to be black in that space, and to feel that you had a say in how the institution is set up, in how public space is marked, was to be treated either with hostility, to be infantilized, or to be trivialized. In the process, legitimate concerns about everyday experiences of racism in the university, as well as the extremely white nature of the curriculum, were swept under the rug. And so this problem preoccupied me as a student activist, but as I thought more and more about it, beyond my interlocutors like Mary Beard in classics or Will Hutton in history and political economy, I began to turn attention toward my own discipline, ostensibly African politics. The field of African politics is itself and remains remarkably racialized, such that, as Adam Branch writes, African continues to be constructed as an object of knowledge by white researchers and not a place where knowledge is produced. A running tension for any lecturer trying to take seriously the politics of knowledge within the discipline of African politics or African studies more generally is this issue of who gets to speak for Africa and on what terms, according to which logics, and based on what forms of knowing. Let's take the question of African politics and put it under the microscope for a few moments. Throughout the annals of African political history, a wide range of scholars from different backgrounds and intellectual inclinations have grappled with this question of how to characterize the African state, its political and economic trajectory, and its relationship to wider society. Yet, one is overwhelmingly struck that throughout the 80s, 90s, and even the 2000s, overwhelmingly much scholarship in Africanist political science has come to portray the continent in virtually pathological categories. This is evidenced by the proliferation of such terms as failure, fragility, the fear of quasi or shadow states, and the belief that African institutions represent little more than vehicles for patronage and corruption. And this has come to represent a canon and a body of common sense about how we talk about politics on the continent. A study in 2016 published in African Affairs looked at and tried to locate where the scholarship was being produced and what models of knowing and understanding the African state were becoming legitimized. Overwhelmingly, not only were African states characterized by pathology, but themes such as violence, elections and democracy, often in continent-wide scales, were what were being published in the top-tier Africanist journals by white scholars, or rather scholars based in the West. This scholarship also tend to privilege large end studies, advanced quantitative methods, and efforts to claim to speak for the continent as a whole. By contrast, scholars writing from within the African continent overwhelmingly focused on what are called local issues, privileged much more historical methods, uses of local languages, and were often treated or rendered as parochial and irrelevant. Indeed, Tandike Mkandawira, a professor at this university, raised precisely these claims at his distinguished Abiola lecture in 1996. And so what we have here is a kind of closed circuit of how knowledge is produced and reinforced, who is cited, what is not only taken as common sense but becomes canonical in characterizing the disciplines. So when we speak of decolonization, this is happening on multiple levels. There is the everyday experience of being African within the Western Academy, but even within the field of African studies, to assert one's own Africanness is paradoxically seen as parochial, is seen as irrelevant. And this observation comes to me each time I engage with scholars at African universities, where the idea that a scholar based in Malawi might come up with a model of the state that speaks to events in Chad is often seen as, at best, bizarre. And I think that takes us then into a wider question of what might academic freedom in Africa look like? What might it mean both to put the African back into African studies, but also to loosen the stranglehold of Western, or dare I say, white scholarship within African studies? Now, I would be the last person to deny that a host of structural factors have hampered academic freedom in Africa. The African university has been afflicted by everything from military authoritarianism to the vagaries of structural adjustment and economic crisis. At the same time, as Jean Ullman tried to address in her presidential lecture at the African Studies Association conference in Atlanta last year, an important aspect of the history of African studies has been the explicit privileging of white scholars within African studies and a host of strategies that have obtained over several decades to exclude African scholars from having stewardship of the discipline. Ullman's lecture has been hailed by a number of scholars as one of the most important interventions by an ASA president within the debate on race and African studies, and also has been bemoaned for the fact that it took a white professor to give it such a public platform. Now, I don't have time to go into all of the debates around the history of African studies, but I'd briefly just highlight one particular incident, which was in 1995, the distinguished professor of African history, Philip Curtin, wrote an op-ed in the Chronicle of Higher Education, arguing that African studies was becoming increasingly ghettoized by the American Academy's attempts to hire more Black and African scholars within the discipline. He went on to write that this was creating an intellectual apartheid such that talented white scholars were no longer able to get jobs within the field of African history. One might continue to ask, to what extent has this really changed? It might not be so explicitly vocalized, but when we have a leading British commentator making claims that it was the British Empire that bequeathed South Africa with the freedom of association, then it shows that we are a long way away from having a meaningful and deep, publicly engaged and well-established African studies that takes forward the views, ideas, epistemologies, and Africans seriously and puts them in the foreground. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Simukai, and thank you for being on the dot on the time. That's perfect. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Lino Som, a senior research fellow at the Makerere Institute for Social Research in Kampala. Lynn just flew in for this, and thank you for being here. She's a political scientist specializing in feminist political economy and political theory, with particular research interests on coloniality, land and agrarian issues, and gender postcolonial subjects of violence. She is the author of Gender, Ethnicity, and Violence in Kenya's Transition to Democracy, States of Violence. She has been a visiting scholar at the National Chiao Tung University in Taiwan and a visiting presidential fellow at Yale University. Lynn, please, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and it's an honor. I was teasing Laura that they flew me in to speak for 10 minutes. It's the nature of the academy. I want to speak about the social and epistemological implications of decolonization, of decolonizing the curriculum, partly because it is a task we have claimed for ourselves at the Makerere Institute of Social Research, where I teach. We don't know how well we are managing. There's a lot of resistance, I can tell you that. I think it's a representation of what every one of us who commits to decolonization has to face and be up against, the resistance, both within and outside. I'll talk more about this. But if what we are saying is that the epistemologies, the methodologies, and the approaches, the disciplinarity that we are currently using have little logic of the epistemic line. So Sabelo Ndlovu has made a distinction between the color line, which we know from Du Bois, and he talks of the epistemic line, and he talks of this as a continuation. And to him, the epistemic line is a denial of our humanity, a denial of the humanity of the colonized, right? So if this is what we are talking about, or part of what we are talking about, then what relevance should decolonized curricula claim for itself? What are its imperatives? What kinds of questions does it pose? And what claims does it make on behalf of the colonized and the subjugated, right? And in this thinking, I think, to begin with, one, we have to state from the onset that a decolonized curriculum must also be a more rigorous one, right? In other words, the colonial curriculum that we have been exposed to has built itself on denying much of reality, right? And if we are going to come back and say we are developing a curriculum that is colonized, of course it has to be more rigorous. But then I want to make a point, because this also brings up the debate between excellence and relevance. I do not think we should collapse into the idea of excellence. I think this still remains an aspiration to the dominant criteria, right? That we are aspiring to something excellent. I think decolonial theories have spoken about this, that there's an element of bad faith, in fact, even decadence, involved in this insistence that we have to be excellent in what we are doing, because there are those of us, including the colonized, including the subjugated, who are standing behind and saying, what can you show me that is better than that other curricula? And we are being forced to be excellent before people actually walk into the door. It is bad faith. And I think we have to make the distinction. And so the question of relevance does not have to cohere with the notion of perfection. That is not the work we are doing. And also, I think the work of decolonizing the curriculum invites structural questions. And especially on the continent, and we've seen this in many places, one of the questions that keeps coming up is that, is it possible to decolonize curricula without a fundamental intervention into the structure of the university? And I mean the colonial structure of the university, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, in Ethiopia, under Meles Zenawi, each federal state was conferred its own university, right? Ostensibly, the aim was to decentralize wealth and resources. What it has, and it depends on which side of the debate you're sitting on. And there's a raging debate in Ethiopia right now under Abiy. But one thing, you know, that we can see objectively is that it has deepened the structural biases that are reproduced through these ethnic homelands, right? And of course, there's an intensive politicization of ethnicity. You know, vice chancellors have become the equivalent of colonial chiefs, right? In South Africa, under the different movements, Fees Must Fall, Roads Must Fall, there was an inability somehow to escape the party lineage politics. And, you know, there was quite a significant amount of co-optation as a source of legitimacy. You know, the ANC had its people. Eventually, it ended up pulling the different student leaders into its own fold, right? In Uganda, where I teach, it's not where I am originally from, Kenya, but, you know, Kenyan universities also have their own dynamics. Uganda, the question of religion, even to the appointment of the vice chancellor, right? Between the Catholic Church, there's always a balance between the Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, the different, you know, you have to appease the Buganda Kingdom. These are legacies of colonialism itself, and they follow us into the current university. So what I'm trying to say is these structural questions are likely to reflect the issues that are considered politically important at the time when it's being agitated. I'm not talking about a false consciousness on the people, on the side of the activists. I'm just saying that those of us who are trying to decolonize in the academy have to be alive to these structural questions, including what Simukai was mentioning about the nature of the university here, you know, its racialized form. I cannot speak much for the global north. Of course, decolonizing curricula is inherently political, right? But its politicization is likely to deepen rather than resolve contradictions. And which are these contradictions? And I think we have to deal concretely with these contradictions. One is that the process of decolonizing curricula is also fundamentally a process of decolonizing society itself, in the sense that, I mean, I ask my students all the time, when, you know, as my doctoral students, you know, they come with a research, with a, what they want to research, and I keep asking them, what is the social question that you want to respond to? And I don't mean it in some mundane way. I mean that we are at a time when we can no longer afford to do theory for the sake of theory. It is nice, and it is a discussion that, you know, part of the exclusion and the silencing of colonized and subjugated voices has been this idea of doing such a thing as pure theory. We might have the luxury of doing this one day when we are fully decolonized. We don't know how that will look like, but not now. You know, a lot of universities and a lot of students in universities and a lot of faculty are also still quite averse to basic research. You know, we have to sort of rearticulate our research aims to that. You know, where does our curriculum, where do we derive our questions? And the point I'm trying to make is we have to derive our questions from the realities that we are dealing with, the social questions that are presenting themselves in society, deal with them, reflect on them, engage them in the academy, and reflect them back onto society. It is a dialectical process, and I think this is one of the demands. There is a huge dystopia between how the colonized experience society and how we tell students, or we as faculty think society is. And it is likely, please, I'm not, I have no awareness of the time. Yeah.
I'm keeping.
Thank you. It is likely that the most profound contradictions that we experience along the line are also going to emerge in relation to the questions and the lines along which society itself is fragmented. So ethnicity, race, gender, class, sexuality, these religion, they emerged in the movements, right? And I think it's a good thing that they emerged in the movements. In South Africa, you know, there were huge fall, and I don't think it's only with the fallist movements, it's also with Occupy, when all these contradictions suddenly came to the surface. So I think, incidentally, there has been a greater expression or acknowledgement or possibility of acknowledging difference, right? But we have to be cautious against the identitarian form, which is a more conservative, it's a, you know, thoroughly liberal, is in a sense. And it doesn't respond to the distinction between the anti-colonial archive, you know, and the, you know, we need to make that distinction also, the anti-colonial archive and the decolonial archive or the decolonization archive. Anti-colonial warriors or strugglers were, difference itself was seen as reactionary, right? There was no room for it to emerge in the concrete ways in which there has been room for it to emerge now. In this period of decolonization, difference is necessary. It has to be seen as progressive. It has to be seen as part and parcel of our struggle. Erasing difference, what an erasure of difference would look like would be to say ethnicity, for example, and violence, and to say these are bad things. And this is what the Western canonical thinking wants us to do. There has been, I think these are unresolved questions, there have been works written about the failure to de-ethnicize, even though the post-colonial period, you know, what we managed to do was de-racialize, but not de-ethnicize. We are still sitting with these contradictions. We can't just put them away and say, you know, so in the way that Simukai was mentioning, and my own work has reflected on this, how every election period reproduces violence and a politicization of different identities. In my own country, Kenya, it has been around ethnicity. But how do we explain this? How do we explain violence in the midst of a system that is, we are told, is supposed to stabilize societies? It is not. Liberal democracy has to be attacked, has to be exposed, right? We have to do this work. So dealing with this partly is asking, is ethnicity and violence that accompanies these forms of competitions a wholly negative force? This is part of what Fanon was talking about. It's not to vulgarize violence. It's not to reach for a vulgar form of it, but to take it seriously as a way of understanding our societies. Almost there. What are the demands? What does decolonization and decolonizing curricula demand for us? And I think one, at the core of it, is a profound solidarity with each other, solidarity in the global south itself, but also those who are committed to decolonization in the north. Anti-imperialism is a necessary positionality. But we also have to be alive to the massive resistance that we are going to face. And that resistance is not just an imperialist resistance. It is also an internal resistance. This is a very scary process. For students, there is an aspiration about entering a structure which you know does not recognize you, but you need it to survive. Mm-hmm. For the academy, for others of us, it is promotions, it is publications. And I think the questions we have to, there's a question of adopting a standpoint. We need to, standpoint versus vantage point. I think the idea of a vantage point, which again Simukai spoke about, and you can have a vantage point anywhere in the world. It's not a geographical question. It is also, again, a political commitment. On whose behalf or with where do you stand in your process of knowledge production? But to end with, I could go on. But to end with, I think decolonization of the curriculum is not something observable. It's not a spectacle. It's not something that we will see. You know, there's an intangibility to it. But it is something we do. And how do we do it? And I think partly it's challenging on a daily basis, the psychological violence that many of us are exposed to inside the classroom and outside. But also to ask ourselves, what forms of knowledge and knowing are we willing to give up? Are we willing to give up the idea that we will not be published in the A-list journals? Because we are writing papers that I've experienced this. I've had a one-year fight with someone who eventually then says the argument is coherent, but you're ignoring centuries of work on democracy. So it is on the basis that you're offending someone's sensibility. You're offending the way in which people have come to understand their own subject areas. Are we willing to give this up? Including the jobs, the publication, the spaces, so the forms of knowledge we are and of knowing we are willing to give up, and the questions we are willing to raise, right? Just one final point. There remains a massive investment in capital, in social, in economic, in political, in moral capital, which is still remains very articulated to a hegemonic center, right? Are we willing to give up this kind of capital, or at least disinvest from this hegemonic center and rebuild anew? Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Lynn. And our next speaker will be Dr. Laura Mann. a sociologist and assistant professor at the Department of International Development at LSE. Her research focuses on the political economy of markets and the new information and communication technologies in Africa. She's currently working on a book project examining the impact of economic ideology of the Islamic movement on higher education in Sudan. And she's also involved in a research project examining the political economy of digital data value chains in agriculture, focusing both on the Rift Valley in Kenya and the Central Valley in California. Laura?
Thank you very much, Jacinta, and thank you to Simukai and Lynn as well for coming to LSE. I don't know if the slide is there.
Oh, the one?
Yeah. I wanted to start off by asking, does anybody know what the motto of LSE is? To know the cause of things, right. So today my little bit of this panel is to talk about why decolonization can help us to know the cause of things. And I think it's important to think about the way in which, how do we understand the world? And what are the limitations of our knowledge when we're thinking about African countries and we're thinking about processes of economic development? And I'm going to break it into two. Firstly, I'm going to talk about how we understand the world. And I'm going to focus a lot on language. So when I was doing my PhD was about Sudan, and I'd spent a couple years learning Arabic, and I spent the first 9 months, I got some extra money, to study Arabic in Sudan. And I then spent a year and a half studying higher education in Sudan. And by the end of it, I could do interviews in Arabic. But every interview I did, I still had to sit down with my language exchange partner and spend a huge amount of time really understanding those interviews. You know, like it took a long time for me not just to get the main points, but to get the nuance of the conversation. And so it was hard and it was slow. And there are probably many things and nuances that I missed. And so I had this barrier to understanding what I was studying. And then after this PhD, I got a job, and the job was about Kenya and Rwanda. And I don't speak Swahili, I don't speak any other Kenyan languages. And I tried to learn Kenya-Rwanda, but I was only in Rwanda for a short period. So my ability to really understand the things that I was studying was very partial, right? I was relying primarily on people who spoke English to interview. Right, and I had partners in the University of Nairobi and the National University of Rwanda who were also doing the research. So obviously that helped our project understand the context. But I think this problem of language is something that we really, 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 really neglect. You know, the ESRC gives a partial extension of scholarships for PhD 6 months or 9 months, depending how much how difficult they think the language is. And often people talk about, you know, when we're looking at promotion and we're looking at who should get a job and we're measuring which researcher is a better researcher. If we were really honest about the commitment to learn a language and to really commit to that, it doesn't take 6 to 9 months to learn Arabic or to learn Swahili or whatever. It takes years and years. So if we're going to compare who to give a PhD scholarship to, a Kenyan researcher who speaks not only Swahili, but whatever the language in question is, versus a British student who doesn't learn those languages, and we want them to do the same quality of work, we're talking about a huge financial cost to train that British student, right? And so, you know, these things matter a lot to the way in which we understand different countries. And when I look at African politics and the scholarship that's done on it, I feel like it really limits my understanding of what is happening within African societies and how people think politically. And just to give you an indication, last year, I don't know if I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, we were hiring somebody in our department to teach development management, which is on the quantitative side of our department. And the short list of candidates were 6 people. They all studied Africa. And I think I don't know if any of them were African, but they all studied Africa. And this is a development studies department, so it could be Asia, it could be Latin America. So that shows you something about how the domination of quantitative statistical studies in understanding Africa, and the fact that there are tons and tons and tons of people who could apply for this job and be top candidates who are working on Africa, right? And if we think about British politics, you know, if we were relying on trying to understand British society by relying on people who didn't speak any English, what kind of, like, understanding would we have about British society? You know, what kinds of methodologies would these people be using to understand British society? You know, if they were relying on only interviewing French speakers in Britain, what a strange picture of British society would get. If they were relying on Arabic speakers, that would be a very interesting, like, understanding of what British society was like. So, you know, it's really important to think about the limitations and in terms of really understanding what is happening by not decolonizing. You know, I think that we really don't know what many people in African countries think politically about things, because we are narrowing and having very reductive ways of understanding these societies. Okay. So the second thing that I want to talk about is that understandings of the world, we're not just describing. Knowledge doesn't describe the world, right? It acts on the world. So in economic sociology, we talk about this in terms of performativity, right? So economics as a profession doesn't just tell us how the economy works. The economic models then go into the world and affect the world in very concrete ways. And we can think about this also in terms of African studies, you know, and I think both Simokai and Lynn talked about this kind of obsession with ethnicity and ethnic containers being a long part of colonial histories in African countries. And I wonder to what extent this way of thinking about African society has affected African society and has affected the way that people themselves think about identity and their nation states. You know, so it's not just that we're getting misunderstandings about African societies, but is that those misunderstandings are affecting things in those societies. You know, both in a very practical level in terms of policy, you know, and we talk about what kind of research is easy to translate into policy recommendations, you know, and language comes in here again. If we're just producing English knowledge, then I guess we're only going to impact people who speak English. Right? So our research isn't necessarily engaged in these societies, and the only way it's going to impact people is perhaps in a very top-down way. But we can also think about the way that our research and the way in which we understand the world affects the way people think in different countries of the world as well. So there's a subtler way in which our misunderstandings and our partial understandings are changing and interacting with people. Okay. And the last thing I want to say is that knowledge itself has a sort of very competitive economic role in our global economy. And I apologize to my students in the room because we have a week of the class about this. But, you know, the economic competitiveness between countries in the world is about knowledge and technology, and how much we invest in these things in society, and also how, you know, the evidence base that we use to make policies at the global level depends on acquiring evidence, and it depends on filtering evidence and conceptualizing evidence. So we can also see how, you know, very colonized knowledge systems have very tangible economic impacts on economic development. So, you know, it might seem weird that I have this book project about higher education and then I'm also studying data, but data is about quantifying things in the world, right? And there's an economic power in quantifying and controlling data systems. So the last thing I want to talk about is how it's quite difficult to decolonize the curriculum, right? If we think about the ways in which the scholarship we have has all of these misunderstandings and partial understandings. How do we talk about that in the classroom? It's very difficult. You know, I teach a course called African Development. I didn't necessarily come up with the name of this course. It was kind of given to me in Tandika Makandawere. 54 countries, 10 weeks. Students don't want more than 4 readings per week, really. How on earth do we do justice to 54 countries and we take on board all of these questions about the partial knowledge, the way that our knowledge systems are have so many misunderstandings and partial knowledge? How do we take on board this idea that knowledge impacts the world, right? If it's a course about economic development. And so it's the challenge of decolonizing curriculum, particularly when it comes to development studies, is quite difficult in the kind of confines that we have as teachers to decide what do we give students to read, how do we divide up a course, how do we divide up Africa in African development. So I think that's it. I also had this one point which kind of talks to what Lynn was saying about the kind of the nature of the university itself. And one of the charges that was leveled against higher education during structural adjustment was a redistributive argument about the fact that these were elite projects, right? That universities were benefiting an urban elite. Right, and there was this idea of the rate of return, that the rate of return for higher education is more private and it's not as big as the rate of return for primary and secondary education. And while I don't think that, you know, higher education should have been destroyed in the way that it was destroyed, I do think there is a redistributive argument there that's quite important, you know, about balancing higher education and balancing it with primary and secondary education and thinking about the way in which higher education should be more in the service of society and thinking about how we can make university education more economically and socially relevant within the countries that it's situated in. So I think I'll end there.
Thank you very much, Laura. And thank you to Simukai, Lynn as well. And a lot of food for thought. Great beginning for our discussion. And so we will open the floor and take the first round of questions. Maybe we can take 5 or 6. Yes?
Thank you very much for the talk. Will Hutton is far right. The clue that he's far right is the quote you gave. Anyone gives a quote like that, that person is far right, whether he calls himself a nice human being or not. So Oxbridge is the heart of darkness. It's an institution built on genocide for the profits and pleasure of the rich. That's its whole purpose, that's its drive, and its only thing it will ever achieve is more horrors upon this world. So Oxbridge needs to end, and institutions around the world that are exactly like that, because it's not just the only one. And the people who own these institutions are the church religions. So because the story of Africa is a story of South America and all the other countries, and above them all is the church. You need, if you want to be a land where the working class can we stand proud of human rights and all the privileges that comes, then the church must be called to bear once and for all. And their institutions of genocide ended and built with institutions of humanity for humans. Thank you very much. No question.
Thank you. Here.
Lynn, you partly answered the question, though, but one part I'm still not very sure. So is part of the aim should be, rather than trying to decolonize these international institutions, because that might be a harder project, we should also be focusing on having a more decentralized university system, which is spread across the world. But in doing so, do you think we run the risk of having sort of this ghettoized university system? So just to take an example, so I'm a student of political theory at LSE, and one of the problems that I feel here is that we have a center for African studies, we have Asian studies, Middle Eastern studies, and then there's a department for government. But all the examples, all the theories that we discuss in Department of Government are European. Mm-hmm. So to what extent should we be striving to make this Department of Government truly international mm-hmm. and inclusive? Or should the aim be that, okay, that probably will never happen. What we instead need is just good universities, popular universities mm-hmm. across the world.
Thank you.
Hi. I'm a master's student at LSE this year, and I think my peers and I have noticed a lot of parts of the curriculum that we would see as colonized, and then we come back and we kind of push against our professors, but, you know, we're only here for a year, then it's another round of students, and, you know, we do our feedback forms and we don't really know what happens with it. And similarly, I think we have a lot of things that reflect a world that's, you know, 20 years ago or more, depending on how frequently our professors actually update their course lists. And so it's very different from what we have seen in the real world just before coming here. So what role could we play when we are here for such a short time in decolonizing the curriculum and making that something that's more visible to prospective students in their choice of degree programs?
Thank you. The lady there.
Thank you for the talk. I came here with a question which Dr. Mann partially touched on, but I'd like to take it just a little bit further. There's a quote by Audre Lorde that the master's tools cannot dismantle the master's house. So my question is, therefore, is it possible to decolonize the curricula in colonial languages?
Thank you. Okay.
I'd like any of the panelists to reflect on the difference between decolonizing the curriculum in the UK, the LSE or Oxford, and decolonizing the curriculum in Kampala or another African country. How do we think about the differences between those two locations?
One more. Yes, please. Then we'll move to the other side. Yes, I can see you.
Thank you. Well, I think the idea of decolonization of the curricula is not a new thing. It probably came with Booker T. Washington, and I think and Du Bois, and they were fighting over that issue. So a few years ago, when I was working in South Africa, one of the French trade representatives asked a question, and he said, we wonder why there are very few South African students in France. And I then asked, why is it that there are also very few French students in South Africa? So I'm studying European institutions. My question is there space for my studies in this decolonizing the curriculum? Or is something else that is an epimysticide in its own right?
Thank you. I think we can take two more. One there. Another one there. And then I'll stop and give you a chance.
No, thank you. I'm from the Workers' Institute. I just like to internalize this discussion to my own experience. I just tell you briefly, my father was a Cambridge graduate. Okay. He was then a code breaker in Bletchley Park, and then he became a university lecturer in Queen's University, Belfast. I have never met anybody who is so racist. Okay. I'll just tell you what happened. When I was a student, I first came to London. The first thing he said to me was, watch out, those black men living across the road. That's the first thing. Second thing is when I, you know, joined a communist collective in Brixton, when he first visited me, the first thing his principal concern whether I was going to sleep with anybody of black or minority ethnic background. So this is my experience, okay? this is about academia, and this goes to the very heart of the British state, you know, because my father was like that, you know. Okay, so, but what I want to say is, what has happened, that was 40 years ago, there's now a prime minister, okay, who takes pride, you know, in having created a hostile environment policy, you know, takes pride, you know, Enoch Powell would be proud of her, I'm sure. Okay. The last thing I want to say is how many university lecturers, okay, have, you know, campaigned on behalf of the Chagos Islanders, you know, for their return to their islands and the terrible injustice. How many have campaigned against the terrible injustice that has been inflicted on them by the British? Thank you.
Thank you. Our last question back there. The gentleman with the yellow scarf.
I guess I'll try to be brief. I think it's interesting that we're looking to restore something. So the question is, what are we trying to restore? So if this is a restoration project, where are we going back to? I ask because I'm Somali. The Somali language came into existence in written form in the 70s. There's no real academic base, if you like, for research into Somalis and Somali history in an academic sense. So they may think that Somalis are knowledge poor, but Somalis are knowledge rich because of the language of Somali. So I think it speaks to, like Fanon was saying, there's a connection between language, land, culture, and dignity. So if there's a connection between those things, and we're bound in the current form in colonial and post-colonial kind of worlds, what are we trying to restore?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Shall we start? Maybe we take Laura in this way.
Okay. So I'm actually going to respond to your question about government and African studies being separate. And this is something that I struggle with, that development studies, in every country is a developing country in the sense of trying to constantly renew, you know, the surplus and redistributing it. And it's also, you know, like I wonder in my class, do I only have things about Africa on the reading list? You know, I've often thought I should put things on my reading list that are about Britain or the US to kind of unsettle this idea of difference and to show the commonalities. And one of the things that I think studying Africa has made me think about a lot is European history. And the U.S., right? And I think anybody that studies a course on African history or African development does think more critically about their own societies as well. So I don't think that decolonization of African studies is just about changing the way we think about Africa. I think it's about changing the way that we think about Europe as well and unsettling what development history really means, right? And the kind of the mainstream narrative of what development involved, the kind of peculiarities of like European experience of development. And it's not mainstream, right? It's the European experience that's quite strange and peculiar. So I think you're absolutely right there. It is a problem of separating things out. And actually, Tandika Makandawire, my colleague, he says that he doesn't like some of the aspects of the decolonization movement because he doesn't like this idea of Africa being different, right? That we have to think about the commonalities as well and have to think about African experiences, implications for Europe and America as well. So I think that's a really important thing to think, like not separating it out, that decolonization means decolonizing the mainstream as well and showing how peculiar certain things are in the mainstream. The power of students, I actually think that LSE students have more power than they realize, that the management of LSE cares at the moment a lot about what students think. And, you know, I don't think it's on your student surveys that you make your power heard. You know, I think it's through student organizations and putting pressure on the management. You guys already put pressure on teachers in many ways, and I would love it if you did that more when it comes to these kinds of questions. Because, for example, for me, I would love to think more critically about my course and restructuring it. But in terms, LSE gives money for using technology in the classroom. It doesn't necessarily give you the support for thinking about these things in terms of time, right? And so I do think that students could probably push more, and that they probably have more power than they're aware. And then the thing about the colonial languages. I mean, I think this is the really, really, really hard, that almost all the knowledge, the kind of legitimate academic knowledge that we're supposed to use on our reading lists has to be in English or maybe French. And I think if that's the way that ideas about policy and ideas, even about research, is communicated even within countries within Africa, then it really shapes like what role knowledge can play in society, right? And yeah. Okay, I think I'll pass on. I think the other questions, I actually really wanted to ask Lynn the same question about what is different about decolonizing curriculum in the UK versus Uganda. So I think I'm nice keen to hear that.
I think that it's a question that I'll partly answer through your question. You know, this risk of ghettoized kind of knowledge. So last year, one of my colleagues allowed a young woman, a master's student who is based in France, to come and, you know, audit her classes. And when the students, you know, the MISA students then during a break asked her, what are you, during the classroom actually asked her, what are you doing here? Why did you come to Uganda? And she says, I came to study violence. And they looked at her and they told her, you mean to say violence doesn't exist in France? Right? You know, this is the thing, this is the vulgarity that we've been subjected to throughout. The idea that you go to Africa to understand violence or to understand any kind of thing that, you know, goes against the Enlightenment or canonical Western thinking about what, you know. And it goes back to what I said. I think you have to understand what is the social question you're dealing with. And if you identify a social question, amongst which is violence, which is poverty, you don't need to be in Africa to understand poverty. You can understand poverty here. I have observed more homeless people sleeping on the streets than I see in Kampala, actually, since I came here 2 days ago. And I think that is it. I think it goes to the broader question of the vantage point, which each of us have spoken about in different ways. I don't think it's a matter of location. And again, another example of a colleague and a friend who did her PhD, her master's in here at Oxford. And one time she was a fallist and got into trouble with a bunch of students who are saying, why do you have to go and study overseas? I don't think that's the point. I think the point is the commitment you have. If you're committed to understanding the position of the subjugated, of the colonized, you do not have to be in India or in Kenya to do it. There has to be a commitment inside everything you write. And feminists did this. You know, I think we all really should look at what feminists have done to theorizing, to the academy. It includes the question the young lady was asking, what can you do in such a short time? You can allow the contradictions and challenges of being yourself in this context emerge. you don't have to conform to whiteness here, or how it is, how do I locate myself in London? You can just be who you are, and those contradictions will emerge, and then you will deal with them. You will deal with them in the academy, you will deal with them in the streets. But that is what you can do. It is part of dealing with reality, and I think decolonization fundamentally has to have an acknowledgement of reality. You can't live outside of it. You're not in some vacuum inside the academy. On the last point, on the question of restoration, to cite Julius Malema, the bad boy of opposition politics in South Africa, I watched this video, I think, a couple of days ago, and I was fascinated by what he was saying. And he was saying, giving an example of young men who, you know, despite having an education, you do not have a job. And when you go home without a job, you cannot sit on the table where people are making decisions. When someone dies, nobody is going to ask you, where do you think we should bury this person? Nobody is even going to wait for you to come before the burial happens. And he said, we are not looking for jobs in that abstract sense of going to industry. Industry is collapsing. It's not producing jobs. He said the jobs are in the land. And there's a euphemism attached to that. It's a question of dignity. It's a question of how do we make sense? How did we make sense of ourselves as a people in terms of resources and wealth that are not attached to this very abstract notion of having to submit yourself to the disciplining regimes of this work or jobs that are disconnected from our lives?
Thank you. Simukai.
I don't have a great deal to add to what's already been said. I think maybe just a couple of short reflections. I think one of the things that this conversation has shown and is in turn reflected in the questions that have been raised is that the word decolonization, the idea of decolonization, is asked to do an awful lot of work. And I think partly because it's asked to do an awful lot of work, it means a number of different things as we move and switch between contexts, as we move between subject matter, as we move between geographies. And actually, when the Rhodes Fall movement started happening in Oxford, this used to stress me out, because we would have these meetings and we'd be like, okay, so we're calling to decolonize the university, but what does that actually mean? And what do we do when we're pressed on this question, like concretely, what do we say? But the flip side of that was it really equipped us with a degree of self-confidence and a vocabulary to say that there is something profoundly wrong with this, with these institutions, with this academy, that's reflective of wider society. So our last comment was about kind of racism in British society. I mean, I was stunned by the responses to Rhodes Must Fall. I mean, I mentioned Will Hutton, and there were many others that really revealed this incredible difficulty I find in British society about how to talk about race, how to acknowledge that whiteness does not belong in a universal or invisible category, but like other forms of identity, it is itself historically constituted and contingent. And because it's historically constituted and contingent, it must be subject to scrutiny like everything else, and that's how we start to expose these power relations. And so in this sense, I found decolonization traveling a long way and helping me think through how we divide, say, academic labor within the academy between disciplinary departments and regionally focused departments, or on the question of, say, the role that students play. I think I was in a slightly privileged position in the sense that when many of the Rhodes Must Fall students I worked with finished their master's degrees and left, and I stayed on for my doctorate and further. And I've seen some of the very small and very subtle changes that have occurred, that actually it did scare people. This was a very establishment. Oxford is a very, very established establishment institution. It is invested in the project of elite reproduction, and it's very, very white. And yet this surprising, uncontrollable language and form of protest initiated by students gave a lot of people pause for reflection. Now, I don't think that that entails by any stretch of the imagination wholesale transformation overnight, but it's a powerful starting point, and I think a point of cautious optimism about how we can begin to understand better how societies are constituted and the ways in which we can needle them and start to push toward change.
Thank you.
There's, I wanted just to give a chance for a couple more questions. And
no, there's one question around the master's tools, which I really would. There are scholars, especially post-colonial theorists, have spoken about something called affirmative sabotage, right? And they're posing that same question, can we use the master's tools? I think we have to be careful. You know, those of us, one, who care about democracy, for example, and who think about it, you know, whichever form they, you know, whether you're thinking of a more radical form or a more, you know. But you can't run away from Enlightenment thought, right? So post-colonial theories, there are some who have stood in very difficult and different engagements with the Enlightenment. But, you know, at the basis of it, there are things we can agree on, no matter which side you're standing on. We can agree that we want societies that are more equal, where we have certain kinds of freedoms or liberties. It is which side it is, you know, what your definition of freedom means. Is it for a few people? Of course, we know that the Enlightenment meant it for, you know, white men, basically. But I think we have to think seriously about, we can't wish it away. In fact, where I teach, students have to have a serious engagement with this canonical text. You cannot dismiss something, and you cannot build a critique based on pretending that other stuff have not been written. But how do you bring it in? And I think, again, back to the vantage point, it depends on which position you're looking at it, and we need to dismantle it, and we need to rebuild it, but we can't wish it away. I think that is a false notion in the decolonization.
Thank you. Thank you, Lee. I think we have time for just two more questions. The lady. Okay. Yes, please, go ahead.
Okay. Hi.
If you don't mind, I think you better.
My question is, how do you think the content of history curriculum affects the unity in African nations, especially for the most marginalized people in society, like how it affects the structure of the society, the history curriculum for basic education, I mean, like how that reflects the structure of society and how it impacts on unity and peace. Thank you.
Just the gentleman next to you.
I'd just like to say that that it's not just Britain, if you like, that colonized Africa. You know, several European countries did, including France, Belgium, etc. And all of these countries themselves from Europe have been colonized equally. Not once, twice. Britain's been colonized several times in the past. Belgium's been colonized untold number of times. France's been colonized so many times. There's very few countries in the world who could probably say, actually, we've not been colonized that much. We're relatively stable. So when you're looking at the concept of colonization, you have to be aware that it is not just equally European countries that has colonized Africa. Africa's been colonized untold number of times by different spheres, different parts of the world, including the Arabic world. Where is your parameters? Where is your yardstick when you're talking about colonization? And equally, when you look at Africa now, African leaders, whether they've been influenced by Oxbridge or LSE education, or they've gone to the Arabic world for their education, they return back to Africa with a colonized kind of mind, which equates hierarchy, inequality, stratification, and what else you could imagine.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
one and two, I had promised. Yes, the lady in the yellow scarf and the... Yes. Go ahead.
This is a similar question to the using the master's tools to dismantle their house. As far as academic or professorships, for students of color as well as people who wish to decolonize the curriculum, would you recommend that we continue to valorize these Oxbridges, Harvards, Princeton with our time and effort and studying there? Do you think it's fruitful, or do you think the more fruitful venture would be to go to schools on the continent or HBCUs, or valorizing out institutions that aren't bastions of whiteness and white supremacy? What would you recommend as being more fruitful for truly decolonizing and building your own institutions and places of power and seats of power?
Thank you. And the last question goes to...
So I do have a question, but just to put it into context, I've worked in psychiatry in Australia's East Arnhem Land, Trinidad and England, and I know at the moment people are talking about increase in mental ill health, but from what I've seen, it's generally been kind of internalizing societal prejudices. And I think one of the main ways of dealing with that is kind of like what you guys have been talking about with acknowledging different ways of knowing and different kind of values and different priorities in society. But then I see kind of how much effort is put into trying to address these issues without changing the overall system and kind of trying to maintain the status quo. And it's more effort to maintain things as they are than it is to kind of address things or to decolonize things. But decolonization is always portrayed as kind of it's such a big thing and we can't do it. So I'm just wondering how you think we do it, especially in society at the moment, kind of with the increasing hostile environment and kind of increasing racism and increasing kind of nationalism and things in politics and in society. Is that something that we have to address as well or first? Or it kind of seems like it'll be harder to address these issues and have kind of discussions around race and things when we kind of almost can't address it just at a basic level in society.
Thank you. Simukai, shall we do this way? 1 minute for each of you, just a final thought. Can be tied to the question or not, but just a closing.
So the question about do we continue to valorize elite institutions that are bastions of white supremacy? This is a question I ask myself every day. And I don't think that there is an entirely straightforward answer to that question, let alone one that's universally applicable. Not least the fact that I need to eat, and as it happens, Oxford is where I got a job. Having said that, what I do think that if you are a black academic, say, and you end up in one of these elite institutions, you have to be alive to the reality that there is the so-called black tax. So that comes and expresses itself in a number of different ways. One of the ways in which it expresses itself is the burden of representation. So in Oxford, for example, the university is divided up into 4 different divisions, academic divisions. The division I'm in is in the social sciences division. In the humanities division, they have 700 associate or full professors. And of those 700, none of them are black. In the social science division, there are 6 of us. So what does that mean? That means that I regularly have black students who've just arrived in Oxford knocking on my door in tears or shaken up or not quite knowing what to say when they've encountered something racist or difficult in the university. That means that you're constantly called to different kinds of events to talk about race and representation or to sit on committees. It also means that you constantly have to prove your worth over and above your white colleagues to legitimate the fact that you are not some kind of token hire. So I have to say I've got a medical degree and 3 master's degrees and a PhD, and I finished it faster than everyone else in the department, and I won the prize for the best dissertation in the country before finally I feel like I can stand on a platform with my white colleagues and say things that they might find uncomfortable. I often think if I was a white dude, the amount of confidence I would be walking with could not be contained in this room.
Just to say that I think that if we succeed in decolonizing, again, it's not a destination, but when we start seeing students actively applying to programs on the continent, mm-hmm. when resources, it's a question of resources also, you know. I think there is a good number of people whose hearts are in the right place. But we can't force it. A lot of programs are under-resourced or just don't have the funding. But when we start seeing a movement of resources horizontally within the global south, the so-called, when the Ivy Leagues begin to lose their shine for people as not the destination where you go and validate yourself and your being, then I think it will happen, but that is part of, I see it as part of an outcome, part of the ways in which we measure what we are doing with this decolonization thing. And just to say, there's a qualitative difference with being a student. I studied in South Africa, which is imbued with whiteness. I have seen the room that one white person can take in a room of 50 or 100 students. It is the equivalent. And then I teach in a program now which is trying to, we are thinking a lot around the question of decolonizing. We take 10 students from the continent, 6 from Uganda, 4 from other African countries. These students are writing PhDs, and you listen and you say, this is why I woke up in the morning. Mm-hmm. You know, and something is happening. There are small efforts. There's a lot of resistance, and there will be a lot of resistance. But there is a possibility to change this equation, and we have to do it deliberately. It won't happen on its own. Yeah.
I'm going to be very quick, but I'm also going to talk to your question. And I've been told stories of really politically engaged people who are coming from a background of experience in African politics, and they're thinking creatively about how to study politics, and they'll go into a conventional political science program, let's say at a North American university, and they're told to think in very conventional means and to use very conventional methodologies. And there's a process of like draining the creativity out of people so that they can become kind of acceptable in certain journals and certain conference circuits and everything else. So I do think there might be more creative space in kind of resisting some of that. But then it is difficult of how do you then, you know, change the American Journal of Political Science or the British Journal of Sociology. So it's, you know, it's kind of a devil's, what is the expression, devil's bargain? The last thing I want to say is that this is a podcast that owes a huge amount of effort and imagination and skill and hard work to Siramaya Willoughby, who's sitting over there. So I just want to give her a little shout out and perhaps a round of applause for all of the work she's done. Siramaya has been at the LSE for a really long time, and she's just left to start a new profession, and I'm so happy that this is like the last thing that we could do together. And I really hope that everybody listens to the podcast and tells us what you think of it. And I have ideas of maybe having a season 2 if I can find the time for it. So please do listen and share it with friends. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much to the whole panel. I will not attempt to make to summarize our discussions, but one thing that I take out of this is this is a necessary process, but also a very hard process. And it's one that it's not going to be an easy one. And as some of the panelists have said,
this is going to be, it's like it's a reality, and we have to live with that reality, accept the contradictions of that reality, address them, and not being afraid of being disruptive and disrupting whiteness, making people uncomfortable, making ourselves uncomfortable, but that's the way to go. And it's not just a question of looking at Western universities and universities in the North, but also in universities at home. What is happening at home? How do we address those kinds of issues? So thank you very much for joining us tonight. I'll ask you to go on a very strong round of applause to this wonderful panel.